Hi, I'm David Freudberg from Humankind. Occasionally on this podcast, we present classic programs from our archive, including the one you'll hear now from our series, Kindred Spirits. For that program, we sought out people of many backgrounds, traditions, and life experiences to understand the personal beliefs that give them purpose and animate their activities. If you like what you hear on this podcast, we're asking for your help to keep it going. Please visit humanmedia.org, and at the top of the homepage, click on How You Can Help. Thanks.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be
God,
with you. Allahu Akbar.
Our Father, who art in heaven,
in te domine speravi, non confundar in aeternum. In you, O Lord, I trust. May I never
Shema
be confounded.
Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad.
Walk cheerfully over the earth, answering that of God in every one.
You're listening to Kindred Spirits.
Welcome to Kindred Spirits. I'm David Freudberg. With us today is Norman Cousins, longtime editor of Saturday Review. His most recent book is Anatomy of an Illness as Perceived by the Patient, Reflections on Healing and Regeneration. It recounts how Mr. Cousins ventured as a layman into the sacred domain of medical treatment. His condition of acute arthritis in the early 1960s was practically permanent. That's what the doctors said. But he devised a successful cure against 500-to-1 odds, a treatment of huge doses of vitamin C and of prolonged periods of laughter. His article in the respected New England Journal of Medicine drew an unprecedented and mostly sympathetic response from doctors all over the world.
Laughter and the use of the vitamin C perhaps needs to be understood in a larger context. The reason I say this is because I don't want people to think who have difficult illnesses that all they have to do is to laugh their way out of an illness or just use vitamin C. Not that both these approaches don't have value in most cases. Those approaches do, but I would hate to encourage people to believe that this is all you have to do. The significant thing, it seems to me, about that particular illness is the doctor and I had a sharing of responsibility. He knew what his job was. I knew what my job was. You see, there's a tendency on the part of people when they become ill to assume that they like a machine, and that the only thing that's necessary is for a mechanic to identify what part is malfunctioning and just to replace that particular part. And this way, they turn themselves over to people they think are just mechanics to do the necessary tinkering around with the machine. But a human being is something quite different from a machine. Actually, my doctor and I were partners in this enterprise. I made some suggestions. I would not have proceeded with those suggestions, however, unless I did have the full support of my doctor. Second, I think it's important to recognize that the human being possesses the most remarkable healing system in all nature. So it becomes necessary in the treatment of disease to ask, why did this disease occur in the first place? Why were those defenses down? What do we do about restoring the immunological system? What do we do about activating the healing system to the fullest? So the wise doctor attempts to put that healing system to work. Medication may be needed at times. That's certainly true, but that medication will work better in combination with the freeing of the body's natural healing system. And the wise doctor recognizes this.
In conjunction with that natural healing system, there needs, as you've spelled out clearly in the book, to be a kind of will to live. And you've demonstrated through your ability to reverse this very difficult disease as you put it, a robust will to live. Where does that come from?
Well, going back just a moment, again, I don't want to create a false impression you just have to think your way through to health, or that all you need is a robust will to live. And that's why I keep stressing the partnership with the doctor. My doctor made a determination in my case. He recognized that we'd reached a point where it was necessary for the patient's will to live to be mobilized. Now, that will to live is not an abstraction. It has a certain biochemical effects. Everything that passes through the brain, fear, hate, rage, joy, all have their physiological effects. The will to live does. And what my doctor was doing was encouraging me in the mobilization of that will to live, knowing that the treatment of any serious disease requires that the patient be enlisted fully in the determination to get well.
Part of your enlistment was a kind of optimistic spirit that came in part from laughter therapy, which I realize people have tended to sensationalize, but just what is it about old candid camera reruns that can heal?
The positive emotions have specific effects on the body's biochemistry, just as much as the negative emotions do. If, for example, you have panic, rage, depression, despair, exasperation, frustration, your body pays a price for this in terms of the biochemical effects. Well, similarly, the will to live, hope, faith, love, laughter are not without their effects. You ask about candid camera in particular. If you see laughter in perspective as one of the positive emotions, then you can assess the helpfulness of laughter. For example, medical profession knows that laughter enhances respiration. Laughter can help to improve circulation. This has been demonstrated. Laughter helps to trigger the endorphins and the enkephalins in the brain that act as the body's natural anesthesia. So it is true that laughter does have a specific physiological and, in this case, therapeutic effect.
In your particular case, Alan Funt of Candid Camera sent you some old movies of reruns of that program, which
yes.
You got a projector and then
yes.
Showed. Could you describe exactly what it was about that situation that you found curative?
Well, I don't know whether it's curative, but I like to laugh, and I feel good after I laugh. This is a phenomenon that is not unique, but I am, I confess, a miserable spoofer. I don't believe in practical jokes because that's silly and it makes people feel ridiculous. But when you have spoofs where everyone can laugh at the incongruities of a situation and where there are no victims, then I think you have the distinction between a practical jokes and spoofs. Well, there were some spoofs on Candid Camera that I think were rather amusing. For example, there was the sequence that showed a man passing a mailbox and suddenly he hears a voice. And the voice came from the direction of the mailbox. And this man was amazed to hear this voice said, "Hey, get me out of here." And he came closer to the mailbox, and the voice said, he said, "If you can hear me," he says, "get me out of here." He said, "What are you doing in that mailbox?" He says, "Don't ask silly questions. I fell in while mailing a letter." Then you get everything proceeding out of it. Well, it's ridiculous, but it makes for laughter. The Marx Brothers help, too.
Marx Brothers films. At one point, you had to move out of the hospital to a hotel room because the laughter in the hospital disturbed other patients. Could you contrast the hotel room atmosphere with the hospitals?
Well, here too, I'm not urging anyone who has to be in the hospital to move out, but my doctor supported the move in this particular case because what had to be done for me could be done just as well near his office. We wanted to be near the doctor. You see, I lived in the country, which otherwise I would have moved home. But we're 50 miles away, so I took a room in an apartment in a hotel not far from his office. Yes, there were some changes, some differences. The first was that it cost about one-third as much. The second was that I was not awakened to be given a sleeping pill. The third was that I found the food, which my wife prepared, much more to my liking. But the fact that a hospital would use white bread, which has dyes in it to make it white, preservatives to keep it on the grocery shelves longer, where this is not just non-nutritional, but really hazardous. The fact that you would have so much sugar in the food, so much flour, all this would seem to indicate, at least at that particular time it did to me, that I wouldn't be doing any harm to myself by going in my wife's, taking my wife's cooking instead.
How did you feel on realizing that the treatment with drugs that you had received originally, high dosage of aspirins and a long drug starting with the word P, that treatment might have been really quite harmful to your condition?
Well, I had my experience to go by, of course. The you do have specific effects. With the aspirin, I had a ringing in my ears. My sight became somewhat blurred because these were very heavy doses of aspirin. Pains in my stomach. And it just seemed to me that I was being toxified. You had other painkillers. And since so many of the medications, including the one with the polysyllabic name that you referred to, that was butazolidine, that's the trade name for it.
That's not how I would have guessed it was pronounced. Go ahead.
You were thinking of the technical name for it. But it became apparent to me that all these drugs and the sleeping pills were designed more for the purpose of easing my pain than for the purpose of treating any underlying problem. The aspirin, theoretically, was supposed to be beneficial because it was supposed to reduce the inflammation in the joints, but it did other things that canceled out whatever the good might be. It weakened fibrinogen. It weakened the clotting process. It impaired collagen formation, and one of the aspects of the kind of disorder that I have, collagen disease, was the fact that anything that impeded or impaired collagen formation ran directly counter to what my body was trying to do. So it seemed to me that all these painkillers were moving me in the wrong direction, even though they might make me free of pain. And basically, it seems to me we tend to be intimidated unduly by pain. And we seem to think that the important thing in illness is to get rid of the pain more than we are concerned with the underlying condition.
And one rather moving passage in the book, you comment that you were willing to stand the pain resulting from removal of these painkillers because you felt the stakes were high enough and you were willing to try. That's
right.
That's a courage.
The moment you recognize that pain is not the ultimate enemy, the ultimate enemy is deceiving yourself into thinking that it is. The ultimate enemy is allowing yourself to be toxified to a point where your body is not strong enough to deal with an underlying condition. And my need was to strengthen my body at that time rather than to weaken it. And if pain was taking me in the wrong direction, if pain was weakening my body, then obviously it was the wrong thing to do. And I knew I could stand the pain so long as I felt that I was on the right track. But one thing we discovered was that it is possible for the body to manufacture its own anesthesia. And it is possible for the body to manufacture its own substances that are like aspirin and like morphine without the penalty of aspirin and morphine. The brain produces enkephalins and endorphins, it's now known, and these act as a natural anesthesia. The question, therefore, is, well, what activates these particular substances, the endorphins and the enkephalins? They're not activated in a condition of apprehension over illness or panic over illness. Quite the contrary, they can be activated by your determination to meet the problem. So in this way, it's possible to get the mind to function inside the autonomic nervous system. This is one of the great things that has been discovered in recent years, that the human body can produce painkillers with morphine-like substances, the enkephalins, endorphins. That it is possible for a human being out of sheer determination to move the brain in this particular direction. Now, once again, I'm not saying that medication under some circumstances may not be necessary. There are circumstances under which medication can save your life, and I had a doctor who knew the difference. But I also had a doctor who recognized that if I was able to withstand the pain, that it'd be much better for me not to be jeopardized by all the toxicity that all these painkillers would represent. Now, and once we got onto this new routine, I was able to discover, for example, that 10 minutes of solid belly laughter would give me 2 hours of pain-free sleep, and that the laughter, as we now know, is probably activating and releasing the endorphins and the enkephalins that my own body produced. Now, this is a much better course, and we're making much better progress because of it.
So God bless Alan Funt. I can't help but be impressed by how facilely you are able to use the medical terms and a number of references in the book, Anatomy of an Illness, to your ability to comprehend articles printed in medical journals. Doctors, like lawyers, are fairly notorious for brutalizing the English language. How did you develop this skill? You don't have any formal medical training.
Well, you see, I at one time had been a medical reporter, and I began with some exposure to the field. Then over the years, I tried to stay with the literature just because it's intrinsic interest. It seems to me that there's no bigger story in the entire world for any reporter's interest in stories. There's no bigger story than the way the human body works. And the development of knowledge with respect to the human body, it seems to me, is one of the major fronts in journalism.
We're talking with Norman Cousins. He's author of Anatomy of an Illness as Perceived by the Patient, Reflections on Healing and Regeneration. One fascinating chapter covers the history of placebos, the use of pills with no real medical value, but which patients are led to believe by their doctors will help them. What does this tell us, the use of placebos and the fact that in so many cases it seems to have induced a circumstance where someone actually improves their health?
For a long time, placebos held a significance for the medical profession only in terms of testing a new drug. They would test this a brand new drug, for example, by using patients who were then given perfectly innocuous drugs, a sugar pill or whatever, and then they would test the results of the active drug, the new drug, against the group having the placebos and people having nothing at all. So for a long time, the placebo was considered only in that particular context. But if a placebo has an effect, if, for example, a placebo is able to create exactly the same effect as an active drug, which it does more than half the time, then the question is, how does this occur? It occurs because the mind tells the body that something is going to happen. When the doctor informs the patient of what the drug is and what the effects of the drug are likely to be, that is the beginning of placebo action. But at that point, you see, that this is where the magic begins, because it's at that point that chemical changes take place inside the body. And this is what I meant when I said that the brain has the power to change body chemistry and to bring about specific effects. The placebo research demonstrated that when people thought that a drug was going to accomplish a specific therapeutic effect, on the upside, perhaps, or even the downside, in more than half the cases, this is exactly what happens. So it becomes important, therefore, to ask, how does this effect take place? And if it takes place with placebos, why couldn't it take place without placebos? In short, if the mind can be trained to instruct the body to do things, Why is it necessary to take the pills? Why not bypass the pills and go directly to the instructions? So the significance of the placebo is that we now know that it is possible for the brain to govern the body to a very large extent. And that is the direction, I think, in which a great deal of medicine is now moving.
The underlying philosophical question, obviously, is where does one draw the line between physical and psychosomatic illness?
Well, it's very difficult to draw the line because most illnesses are a result of that interaction. What happens in the mind can weaken the body. Also, the weakening of the body can also produce a weakening of the mind. So I don't think that it's necessary to ask to what extent is it mind and to what extent is it body. The fact of the matter is that generally it's both.
How would you define a constructive relationship between doctor and patient?
A definition of a good relationship between a physician and the patient is that each recognizes that there's a job to be done, each respects the other. The doctor knows that his medication will work better if the patient's attitude is right. And also the patient's attitude depends a great deal upon the doctor's attitude. A doctor who earns and keeps the confidence of a patient can do a much better job for that patient than someone who's completely impersonal, because the doctor recognizes that to a large extent he's going to have a placebo effect. 85% of the people who go to doctor's offices have nothing really the matter with them, which is to say they have no organic illness, but they have symptoms, and those symptoms are real. But the problems behind those symptoms tend to be self-limiting. So the doctor recognizes that it's very important with most of his patients to get them over panic, to ease their apprehensions, and to free their body's own healing system so that self-limiting process will function as it was intended to function. But the doctor who is impersonal, who regards people as objects only as appendages to charts, may be the most knowledgeable in the world, most proficient in the world, but he is incomplete in the sense that he's only doing part of his job.
How much do you fault the increasingly technological nature of modern American medical treatment for the impersonal quality that so many people feel in going to a doctor's?
Well, when you talk about personalization, you're talking about persons. And the more persons you talk about, the less personal it becomes. Also, the greater the technology, the greater the distance from the center, the greater the distance from the central physician who monitors and supervises the case. So I think that you're quite right. One of the unfortunate aspects of increasing technology and also increasing specialization is that it subjects the patient to increasingly impersonal experiences. This may be of great assistance to the doctor in terms of a diagnosis, but not necessarily of increased use to the doctor in terms of the therapy or his ability to gain the support of the patient. A patient who feels that he is in a sterile and an impersonal environment where he lacks the kind of emotional support necessary for him to release his own resources. Such a person, it seems to me, is not apt to do as well as a patient who knows that even though he may require various tests, computerized tests or whatever, that he knows that his doctor is staying very close to him, that his doctor is not just turning him over to the specialist, but the doctor is trying to make use of specialists rather than just subjecting the patient to a group of rather remote experiences. I had, as I said at the outset, an excellent doctor who combined his science with his art. Someone who was expert at being a doctor, but at the same time understood the importance of compassion and understood also the importance of the relationship with the patient. And there are many doctors like this, but there are some doctors who are not. To the extent that this creates problems, it seems to me we can discuss those problems rather fully and rather frankly. One of the problems that concerns me has to do with the truth-telling. in especially severe cases. In recent years, it's been fashionable to tell the truth to patients. But the issue, it seems to me, is not whether you tell the truth or don't tell the truth. There are some other issues, prior issues. For example, number one, does the doctor always know the truth? And the answer is no, that the doctor does not always know the truth. The doctor cannot always say that a disease would be fatal. There are too many remissions, too many things that have astounded the medical profession for a doctor to make that flat statement. And making that flat statement, you see, sometimes does reduce the ability of the patient to fight back. It does inhibit that the activation of the patient's full resources. So you've got the second thing, namely, which is how do you tell the truth in a way that discharges the doctor's responsibility, but at the same time keeps the will to live alive and doesn't rob the patient of hope. And there are a lot of doctors, I must say, who understand this art, who practice this art, who are compassionate. Some doctors are not. Some doctors, truth will unload the truth like a ton of brick on a patient and devastate the patient and also devastate the family. But most doctors, I'm glad to say, recognize that there's a way of telling the truth. What do we mean by that? Well, I saw a good demonstration of that with a patient who had a prostatic cancer. The cancer had spread. The x-rays revealed that there was metastases, very serious metastases. What this doctor did was to sit the patient down and explain the condition to him. He said, I know your condition is serious. Explain what the condition was. He said, but what does this mean? It means that you have a job to do and I have a job to do. These are both important jobs. Now, I want to do my job well, but if I'm to do that job well, it means that you've got to do your job well. I've got to give you estrogen. I've got to knock out the male hormone. We might have to have some surgery. As to that, I cannot say. But whether I do my job well depends on the responsiveness of the patient. You've got to give me a good field. I want all your body chemistry to work for me and to work for you, and I'm going to do a better job. So he said, I want you to experience joys you've never experienced before. I want you to exercise your will to live as you've never exercised it before. I want you to laugh and have a good time as you've never laughed before or had a good time before. And by having complete confidence in me and knowing that the word cancer and the word death are not synonymous, and by putting up a big fight, we've got a good chance. No guarantees. You never have any guarantees in anything, but we've got a chance. Would you fight with me? And the patient said yes. And within 1 year, half those lesions had disappeared, and that patient is alive today. Now, I'm not saying that this will happen with all patients, obviously. We're not immortal. There are some diseases which have reached the point where they're not reversible. But also, it is also true that there are many conditions that are potentially reversible, where the patient's chances are reduced precisely because panic rather than confidence governs the mindset of that particular patient. Now, the wise doctor recognizes this. The wise doctor recognizes that panic is a disease in itself. And you certainly don't want to add this disease to the other disease because the combination can be lethal.
Talking with Norman Cousins, longtime editor of Saturday Review, and author most recently of Anatomy of an Illness as Perceived by the Patient, Reflections on Healing and Regeneration.
Kindred Spirits is produced by David Freudberg and Public Media Foundation, with production assistance from Lee Ellen Marvin. Theme music by Russ Barenberg and Alan Byrne. Studio recording at WGBH, Boston. If you'd like to receive a cassette tape of this program, or if you have questions or comments, we warmly invite you to write us at Kindred Spirits, Post Office Box 777, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02139. That's Kindred Spirits, Box 777, Cambridge, Mass., 02139. Special thanks to the Satellite Program Development Fund at National Public Radio, the Permanent Charity Fund of Boston, the Campbell and Hall Charity Fund, and public radio stations WGBH, WNYC, and WFCR, whose generous support made Kindred Spirits possible. Thank you very much for listening, and may the spirit of unity bring you peace. This is the Public Radio Cooperative.
To hear more episodes of Humankind, you can subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast player. A new episode each week. The podcast title is Humankind on Public Radio. And if you enjoy this program, be sure to leave us a kind review at iTunes and Stitcher. If you want to support the program, please visit humanmedia.org. And at the top of the homepage, click on How You Can Help. Again, our web address is humanmedia.org. Thanks.